Days before Kathleen's death, we were discussing the beautiful dress and matching coat that she was planning to wear to the governor of North Carolina's Christmas party. Now Kathleen is buried in this dress and matching shoes. Heartbreak is real, and it brings real pain to the human body. It's been over 15 years since Michael Peterson called my husband and told him that my sister Kathleen had fallen down the stairs and died. Those were his words. Michael Peterson's fictionalized story of my sister's death began December 9, 2001, a phone call on a Sunday morning barely 2 weeks before Christmas. There were three sisters, Kathleen, me, and Lori. Now there were two sisters.
Criminal cases in the Triangle's history could be coming to an end soon after more than a decade. The attorney for novelist Michael Peterson says a deal has been reached that will resolve the 2001 case. Peterson was accused of killing his wife, Kathleen.
It's a case that spanned more than 15 years. Mike Peterson has been in and out of Durham County Court since first being accused of killing his wife, Kathleen, in 2001. He's maintained his innocence, saying his wife fell. He was convicted of murder in 2003, but released in 2011 after that conviction was overturned. A judge determined one of the state's key witnesses lied on the stand about evidence.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me remotely today is...
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, former criminal behavioral analyst of New Scotland Yard, and author of the book Policing Domestic Violence.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am casting director at CBS's Criminal Minds, and I'm coming to you from my casting trailer. So... please excuse any air conditioning and voices you hear.
And today we're really excited to finally be covering the Netflix original series, The Staircase. This has been a case that has been going on for a very long time, almost two decades. And recently there have been incredible new developments, as well as three additional episodes to this ongoing docuseries. The thing about this case was that the documentarians had unprecedented access almost from the very first day of this crime. And so we're treated to access that normally you never get in a documentary series.
Well, of course, Jim, the question is about whether it is a crime. You know, that's the whole premise of it. And the documentarian actually refers to it, Jean-Javier de l'Estrade. He was the French film director who was the director of this project for 15 years, and he always called it a death. He never once mentions the word murder in any of his interviews, and that's what we're going to get into today and in subsequent episodes.
It's one of the things that we've talked about with respect to other documentary series that, in fact, a documentary series, for the most part, has sort of a perspective that some people choose before they even start filming, and others, what like we try to do, Laura, is actually go in and discover what's actually going on and let the facts speak for themselves, as opposed to trying to manipulate the audience and what they get to see and don't see.
Right. And this is 13 episodes, each 45 minutes long, and the access is incredible. It's incredibly absorbing. And I believe he started filming about 7 weeks after what he says is the death. But I think the whole way it's been constructed, I mean, you know, it does take you on a journey. Obviously, part of that journey is this a crime or was it an accident? But the music and the tone, and I know, Lisa, you'll probably say quite a lot about that in terms of how some of the mood and the tone that he's trying to set helps the audience go in a certain direction. And we talked about that a little bit with Making a Murderer, but I see signs of that across these 13 episodes. What do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, well, the music by Jocelyn Pook is the very first thing I noticed when I cracked open this documentary. The music was just overwhelmingly evocative, almost as much as The Keeper, which we all loved. Yeah, I was absolutely stunned when I was watching this by the access, and it was puzzling to me. Why would a defense attorney allow a film crew this kind of access? Because if you remember back with the West Memphis Three, Barry Scheck kicked those guys to the curb when he took over the case.
Right.
He was like...
But Lisa,
Yeah.
The defense attorney cannot allow access like this without the consent of the defendant.
Sure.
But that tells us something behaviorally. He wanted this. And I think this is a theme that I see running throughout the entire series, that Mr. Mike Peterson loved the spotlight, loved being in front of the camera, just swelled with pride and emotion when he was in front of the camera. He had his 15 minutes of fame that went on for 15 years.
That's right. I wanted to jump in and talk about Jean-Xavier de l'Estrade, whose first documentary, Murder on a Sunday Morning, won the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2001. And it's important to notice that that documentary was about somebody of no means using a public defender to go through the system and whether or not they could get a fair trial. So for his next film, he was looking for somebody with incredible means who was up on a murder charge that he could follow the same way. And I guess he looked through 300 cases before he found them or they found him or whatever. And he was allowed this access. But it's interesting that he started for 4 months, he followed the defense, and 4 months he followed the prosecution at the same time. And then the prosecution said, get out of here. We don't want you here, you know, for whatever reason. And so his access to them was cut off. And we did see this in Making a Murder as well. So he ended up following, for better or worse, just the defense. And yeah, it did completely turn the lens in a different way. And when I was watching it, I could not believe the kind of detail that they were filming it like a film. I mean, they were close up on something and then they do a slow pan to something else. And it looked almost staged to me at some points. And that is something I do not like, as you know.
I was just going to say about the prosecutors and them opting out of this production. It may very well be that the reason why they opted out was because they experienced a bias on the part of them and did not want to participate anymore. Or it could just be that they didn't want to, risk some kind of mistrial or something. And so they stayed away from it.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I want to be fair to the filmmaker, too, who's not here to defend himself. And
neither are the prosecutors, right?
Yeah, well, they were. I mean, they did have some camera time for sure that we saw behind the scenes as well as in court that I did see. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with Making a Murderer, we talked about the fact that it was very much shot from the Avery point of view. And you know, we know certainly, and I do in terms of cases, and certainly when we see it on the TV and putting them together, that when you spend a lot of time with those people, there is a part of you that does naturally bond with those individuals. And I feel that there are signs of that the whole way throughout this documentary. And certainly at there's a pool scene, and I can't remember which episode it is. I think it might be 10 or 11, but Michael Peterson is in the pool with all the family. There's lots of these family shots of them. But he calls to his grandson, and I think his grandson may be called Jean. That little moment where he says Jean and he jumps into the pool. I mean, I don't know whether he was named after the director, but of course you had those little moments as well, that when he hears the news that he's going to get a retrial after the appeal, then Jean is in the prison cell or at the courthouse with him, and they embrace and there's hugs all round, and you know, and he holds him sort of in very high regard, that trust has been built. And, you know, I know I'm skipping towards the end, but I think there are those moments throughout where we see a very biased view towards the Peterson family. And I want to talk a bit about the family dynamics as well, because I don't know about you, Jim, but I certainly saw some very interesting things just in terms of how the family will interact.
Let's just track back for 1 second, though, because, you know, Trey, who did Evil Genius, he admitted that he did get attached to Marjorie, you know, throughout the process. You know, it's almost impossible not to, even if you think that they're a killer. And I think that Lestrade has said that he doesn't know if Michael Peterson is guilty or not, but he couldn't help but hug him in that moment. He's talked about that moment where he did get up and hug him and he regrets that. Think of it as a filmmaker. If the only access you have is this, do you not shoot them? I mean, I did not like all of the shots in the pool and all this and that. But I mean, what do you do you guys are producers and filmmakers. What do you do if you only have access to that?
Well, it's not just that you only have access to that. I mean, it's what does that actually mean? I mean, the fact that he has a family and they love him and they interact and he's gregarious and charismatic and all that doesn't actually weigh one way or the other. In fact, it may very well weigh against him inadvertently. In other words, for example, let's start from the beginning. And basically, he gives a tour around the crime scene.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, casually, you know, just as if he's talking about, you know, a birthday party or, you know, a dinner event or something like that. I mean, and this is a number of weeks after his wife was found dead by him. And the blood is still soaked into the floorboards. It's still on the floor. It's still on the walls. Her blood. She bled to death there. So to have him be so casual, it to me, actually tells me that this is not somebody who really has a lot of human empathy. That this doesn't actually affect him like it should if he actually were a normal, emotionally balanced, stable human being.
Right. And I found it very bizarre, I have to say, that they are all still living in that house, irrespective of what happened or didn't happen. But the fact that they're all there and that tour's happening and just some of those interactions, you know, the wine drinking, all of the things, you know, the little snippets that you see of them that paints a picture. But I think perhaps we should start with the victimology and talk a little bit about Kathleen. Sure. And their relationship, shall we, in terms of, you know, who she was. So what we know about Kathleen, and I did find an absence of commentary about her, just even though Peterson says at the end that some people say that not enough is said about Kathleen, but just in terms of who she was and what she was about and her and the marriage with Michael. Well, we know she was 48 years old when she died, and there were 5 children in that family house. But of course, they weren't all children from their marriage. And I think that's an interesting dynamic. And we can talk about Margaret and Martha, but they operate as a unit, a family unit, pretty much. But I think some of the things that we understood about Kathleen and Michael, well, at the start, people talked about them, including family members, as having this kind of soulmate relationship, you know, that they were meant to be together. They were very much in love. And we did see pictures of that, didn't we, through the documentary right at the start. But I think some of the interesting things that are helpful that I understood was that actually Kathleen was quite worried about her job, and not just her job, about the relationship with Michael. And she actually worked for Nortel, and Nortel was in trouble at the time. And that evening, she was due to set up a conference call. And that conference call was an important call for her. So, you know, we can talk about the timeline, but her job was important to her. She was on something like, let me just double check, I think it was something like £112,000 that she would get a year. But the family were actually in debt to the tune of $143,000 that they had run up on credit cards. And obviously they had 5 children who were they sort of 18, 19, 20, something that mark? So it's still, you know, going through college, et cetera, and still finding tuition fees. There was some financial constraint because their house was fairly big, I think 6 bedrooms, wasn't it? In terms of the upkeep of that house and the swimming pool and so on and so forth, they lived a fairly lavish lifestyle. And she was also concerned about Michael. She felt that he was being a bit shifty and had been saying he was going to the gym and doing things, but not coming back for some time.
And we'll later find out really what the basis of that is. But it's interesting, though, that they're living this sort of lavish lifestyle and Michael doesn't seem to be contributing to it. In other words, he's living it. He's getting the benefit, but she's the one bringing in the money, not him.
His income as a writer didn't contribute to that estate?
I think it waxed and waned. I mean, you know, he wrote some things, but I think that she seemed to be the breadwinner, as it were. $150,000 she was on with, and Nortel was in trouble at that time, her company. And so what I've been reading about that particular evening, and I think, Jim, I'd love to hear your view just on the timeline. You know, she wanted to set up this conference call, and she apparently, after they'd been watching a movie and had drunk some wine and been outside by the swimming pool, she had gone in to send this email and went into his study because her laptop was somewhere else. And so there's a question mark about that. But in terms of her views and her personality and characteristics, she was married before and she divorced her first husband when she found out that he was seeing someone else. She had a very strong view around infidelity, and it was a deal breaker for her.
It's been 10 years. All I want right now is to just, you know, focus on the memory of my mother instead of the real injustice that's here, which is that she didn't get a fair trial. The man who murdered her is walking free, not free. He's still charged with her murder, but he's home under house arrest, and she's dead because of him.
I don't know how we can really discuss this without going forward a little bit. I mean, both the computer and this extramarital affair issue, I think, actually are incredibly, critically important mm-hmm. in this case. A, she went in to use the computer, and later when a search was done on that very computer, on his computer in the den, they found images of gay pornography. And they would later find also emails where Michael Peterson was setting up sexual liaisons with mm-hmm. men. And Peterson would have everybody believe that Kathleen was aware of this and that she tacitly approved of it. When, as you point out, Laura, this is the reason why she ended her first marriage was infidelity. Why would she be okay with infidelity? Especially since it was infidelity with guys by her husband. I mean, it seems to me that that would be an exacerbating factor, not a mitigating
question.
Factor.
So we know that she used his computer because he says she did, or how do we know that? I mean, all the things that you said about the wine, she was out there with the wine, that's from his accounting of it, right? I mean, do we even know that that happened?
Yeah. Well, his account is that they had watched a movie till 11, they drank wine, then they go outside. And we have to bear in mind this is December. It's about 12 degrees. They go outside. So let's say they finish the movie around 11. That's his version of events. They go outside, which is some walk away from the house to sit by the pool. You know, he smokes his pipe. You know, I'm not sure if she's a smoker, but they're out there. I mean, they wouldn't be out there for a huge amount of time, I wouldn't have thought, given that it's December. And she goes back in.
And he's wearing shorts when they find him, mm-hmm. shorts. And he says he didn't get changed, that he came in from outside. And he's there with shorts, with blood on them, when they arrive.
But he's the one who says that she went, who says that she used the computer and she's the one who found these images?
He says that, and I think that's also what the director said, although when Rudolph was questioned about the timeline, because everything does come down to the timeline, even David Rudolph said he never really questioned Michael Peterson about that timeline, the window from 11 o'clock until 2:38 in the morning. But the suggestion was from him, from Peterson, that she had to send an email. That's why she went in, and she had to be up early the next day for this conference call.
Right. So there would have been a record if that email was sent of when it was sent and from where it was sent. So those are facts that could have been verified or refuted during the trial. So I'm going to have to assume that, you know, because they're on the record still, that they were verified. That's the facts as we know them. That's all. Whether they're corroborated or not, I just don't know.
Can I just say just something about Kathleen? What an amazing woman it takes to accept four children who are not your own into your home in addition to your daughter. I mean, that is a very hard alchemy to balance as a mom. And the fact that she, you know, raised those kids as her own and they clearly bonded with her in the wake of her death, throughout the entire documentary, they call her mom and everything. I mean, that speaks, I think, a lot to her maternalness and her love for her family and you know, feeling betrayed by that. You know, that must have been horrifying.
Well, it's one thing to be betrayed, but it's another thing to find out that your life, what you thought it was, is not. And we have to remember, if he has been leading this double life, that is huge. You know, for somebody like Kathleen, who seems to be very straight down the middle, i.e., you know, any infidelity, she has very strong views on. But this isn't just about infidelity. This is about him leading a double life. And therefore, we know if he's able to sustain that double life, and remember his brother said, well, he knew he was bisexual from the age of 13. Now, for me, it's not a judgment about him being bisexual. It's more about him being honest and what impact that may have had on Kathleen in terms of what she thought her life was all about suddenly unravels in a short period of time. And I would believe that that would have a significant impact on her.
Yeah, of course it would. I mean, why wouldn't it? It strains the boundaries of logic and credibility for him to say at first, to suggest that she approved of it, and then, well, on further questioning, well, we actually never talked about it, but she kind of tacitly approved of it. Well, that doesn't sound consistent with her very staunch behavior in this area. Fidelity was what broke up her first marriage. Why would that change in her second marriage?
Exactly. That double standard seems very unlikely. And if in the background as well, I'm just going to put it out there, that what she also had a 1.8 million life insurance in the event of her death. Again, just in terms of background, there are some interesting aspects to the couple, obviously the infidelity issue, but also the debt that they found themselves in.
Right, because especially if it's credit card debt, everybody in the world knows that credit card debt is the most difficult debt to get rid of, that it just can just accumulate and accumulate and overwhelm people. And if they had so much in credit card debt, and if her business was having difficulties, this financial strain could have been very serious. And we know that, you know, when husbands kill wives, that a lot of times there are fidelity issues and financial issues that are the motivating factors.
And separation issues and control issues in the main. Although I didn't see, you know, get a sense of that aspect. But I think he is a very interesting and complex character. And perhaps we can get into some of the behavioral things, the leakage aspects that we see with him, Jim, as well. Because I think there's a lot of material that we see of him. There's a lot of very self-indulgent moments.
Absolutely. You hit it right on the head. Self-indulgent.
Very, that I think are very interesting. And it could just be put down to, oh, well, that's who we had access to. But I didn't feel that it was just about that's who we have access to. I think that there were parts to be played and acted at times.
And but it's how he, it, and you're right. I think it did seem like he was playing a part and acting. And when it came down to brass tacks, he would talk about how it affected him, not how it affected his dead wife. Not the fact that it resulted in her death. This is a critical difference between somebody who is really devastated by the death of somebody they love and really somebody else who's really only self-interested.
Kathleen was a terrific woman. She's the only reason I ever saw my father happy. I never knew my father to be happy until Kathleen came along. She made a family out of nothing. She had a wonderful marriage with my father, and she took in Margaret and Martha and made them her own daughters. She is the single greatest source of happiness to the people that I hold so close to me. She made my father's life. She made Margaret Martha's life. And I love her for that. She, quite simply, she's done more for the people that I've known and loved, done more for them than anyone I've ever known. And I'll always love her for that.
When we see him in that first episode and he's showing people around the house and where they were sitting, and he walks it all through, you know, the last time he saw her. How long was that after her death? Do you know? Do you remember?
It was 7 weeks after her death, as the director calls it, that they started filming. So I would imagine, and I think it took him some time to gain Michael Peterson's trust to actually be able to get access to the house. So we're talking a number of months, effectively.
Okay, because to me it's felt like years. I mean, like, he was kind of so nonchalantly, like, kind of skipping over. I don't know. For me, it felt very odd. Like, I was completely lost at what the timeline was, the way he was very casual.
Yeah, it looks like it was 4 or 5 months, and then he was allowed to film in the house. So then he got full access after Michael Peterson started to trust him.
Right. And remember, part of that time, Peterson was actually in jail, right? So
yes.
So that would have been, you know, a delay. So it was actually a more compressed time period that he actually agreed to this. But here's the thing. In order for Peterson to do it, and you know, believe me, I know that a defense attorney would have to have some kind of, you know, really important and critical talk with his defendant before he allowed something like that to happen. So it's not only that Peterson wanted to do it, but the defense attorney was convinced that this would be a good thing for Peterson. Now, maybe it's because he thought at that point, well, their only suspect is Peterson, and I believe he's innocent. As his defense attorney, he believed he's innocent. So he just said, well, I think it's the best way to get, you know, people to understand what the facts are. But unfortunately, throughout this whole series, you can see events in which his defense attorney was like worried. Well, is your DNA going to be on this? Are we going to find that? Are we going to, you know, very, very worried that there was going to be incriminating evidence that would come
out. Doesn't the attorney-client privilege get sort of thrown out if somebody's recording you?
It is only thrown out if it is waived by the defendant. The defendant, the client, is the only one who can waive that. The attorney can't. So that's why I'm saying Peterson is the driving force behind this documentary being filmed at all.
But what I'm saying is that the prosecution could have access to all of this because it's not confidential anymore. And I think that they actually tried to get it, and that's why the filmmaker kept shifting all the dailies, because I think back then they were using film, you know, to Paris like every night after they were shooting, so that the prosecutor couldn't get it.
I don't think that's actually legitimate or legal for somebody to do. I mean, if you're filming something in the United States, you should be governed by the laws of the United States. And I think that's slimy that he did that. If he did that, he's obviously protecting Peterson. Now, Peterson agreed to do it, so there's a documentation of it. So that should be subject to discovery by the prosecution. That's the laws of the United States, and that should have been what ruled.
Yeah, agree. I just want to add that of all of the true crime documentaries, this one has been the number one requested case that we cover. People have been clamoring about it for 2 years. And I...
Well, more than that.
For you.
I mean, we talked about doing it a while ago, didn't we?
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Everyone was really excited about it, but then we had other things come in. So it's great to return to it and now see the extra episodes.
Well, when we come back, we'll definitely have to cover the 911 tape because that's a very interesting 911 call.
That's right. And we have all of your questions from Facebook that you have for Jim and Laura that we're going to go through. We're going to go through everything, the owl, the whatever, whatever.
I'm not sure we're going to go through the owl, but there's lots of other really interesting points and aspects of behavior that Jim and I would really like to cover. And keep your questions coming. Put them on Twitter as well. I know many of you have asked us to do the staircase on Twitter and also on Instagram. We have an Instagram account now at Real Crime Profile.
Before we sign off, do you guys have any recs? Because I have one. So I've been watching this great Australian show called Secret City. That is on Netflix. I guess everything I watch is on Netflix. Starring Anna Torv, who you'll remember as Dr. Wendy from Mindhunter. She wears totally different blouses in this one, and I'm already talking about it with people on Facebook.
What about the wallpaper? How's that?
Okay, there's no wallpaper, but there is this shade of teal that all the walls are painted that I'm obsessed with. But anyway, if Jim knows my office, like half of the things in here are teal, so I'm very obsessed with that color. But anyway, okay, so Secret City, starring Anna Torv and Dan Wiley, very famous Australian actor. So check that out on Netflix.
Well, till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.